more display like that, Mr. Potter, and you will be returning that time turner. Do I make myself very clear?
Yes, Harry said. I understand, and I'm sorry.
Then, Mr. Potter, you will be allowed to retain the time turner for now. And considering the size of the debacle you did, in fact, avert, I will not deduct any points from Ravenclaw.
Plus, you couldn't explain why you deducted the points. But Harry wasn't dumb enough to say that out loud. More importantly, why did the Rememberall go off like that? Harry said. Does it mean I've been obliviated?
That puzzles me as well,
Professor McGonagall said slowly.
If it were that simple, I would think that the courts would use Rememberalls, and they don't. I shall look into it, Mr. Potter,
she sighed.
You can go now.
Harry started to get up from his chair, then halted.
Sorry, I did have something else I wanted to tell you.
You could hardly see the flinch.
What is it, Mr. Potter?
It's about Professor Quirrell.
I'm sure, Mr. Potter, that it's nothing of importance.
Professor McGonagall spoke the words in a great rush.
Surely you heard the headmaster tell the students that you were not to bother us with any unimportant complaints about the defence professor?
Harry was rather confused.
But this could be important. Yesterday I got this sudden sense of doom when...
Mr. Potter, I have a sense of doom as well, and my sense of doom is suggesting that you must not finish that sentence.
Harry's mouth gaped open. Professor McGonagall had succeeded. Harry was speechless.
Mr. Potter,
said Professor McGonagall,
if you have discovered anything that seems interesting about Professor Quirrell, please feel free not to share it with me or anyone else. No. I think you've taken up enough of my valuable time.
This isn't like you,
Harry burst out.
I'm sorry, but that just seems unbelievably irresponsible. From what I've heard, there's some kind of jinx on the defence position. And if you already know something's going to go wrong, I'd think you'd all be on your toes.
Go wrong, Mr. Potter? I certainly hope not.
Professor McGonagall's face was expressionless.
After Professor Blake was caught in a closet with no fewer than 3 fifth-year Slytherins last February, and a year before that, Professor Summers failed so completely as an educator that her students thought a boggart was a kind of furniture, it would be catastrophic if some problem with the extraordinary competent Professor Quirrell came to my attention now, and I dare say most of our students would fail their defence OWLs and NEWTs.
I see,
Harry said slowly, taking it all in.
So, in other words, whatever's wrong with Professor Quirrell, you desperately don't want to know about it until the end of the school year. And since it's currently September, he could assassinate the Prime Minister on live television and get away with it so far as you're concerned.
Professor McGonagall gazed at him unblinkingly.
I'm certain that I could never be heard endorsing such a statement, Mr. Potter. At Hogwarts, we strive to be proactive with respect to anything that threatens the educational attainment of our students.
Such as first-year Ravenclaws who can't keep their mouths shut. I believe I understand you completely, Professor McGonagall.
Oh, I doubt that, Mr. Potter. I doubt that very much.
Professor McGonagall leaned forward, her face tightening again.
"Since you and I have already discussed matters far more sensitive than these, I shall speak frankly. You, and you alone, have reported this mysterious sense of doom. You, and you alone, are a chaos magnet the likes of which I have never seen. After our little shopping trip to Diagon Alley, and then the sorting hat, and then today's little episode, I can well foresee that I am fated to sit in the headmaster's office and hear some hilarious tale about Professor Quirrell in which you, and you alone, play a starring role, after which there will be no choice but to fire him. I am already resigned to it, Mr. Potter, and if this sad event takes place any earlier than the Ides of May, I will string you up by the gates of Hogwarts with your own intestines and pour fire beetles into your nose. Now, do you understand me completely?"
Harry nodded, his eyes very wide. Then, after a second,
"What do I get if I can make it happen on the last day of the school year?"
"Get out of my office!"
Thursday. There must have been something about Thursdays in Hogwarts. It was 5:32 p.m. on Thursday afternoon, and Harry was standing next to Professor Flitwick, in front of the great stone gargoyle that guarded the entrance to the headmaster's office. No sooner had he made it back from Professor McGonagall's office to the Ravenclaw study rooms than one of the students told him to report to Professor Flitwick's office, and there Harry had learned that Dumbledore wanted to speak to him. Harry, feeling rather apprehensive, had asked Professor Flitwick if the headmaster had said what this was about. Professor Flitwick had shrugged in a helpless sort of way. Apparently, Dumbledore had said that Harry was far too young to invoke the words of power and madness.
"Abby, Abby, boom, boom, swamp, swamp, swamp,"
Harry had thought, but not said aloud.
"Please don't worry too much, Mr. Potter,"
squeaked Professor Flitwick from somewhere around Harry's shoulder level. Harry was grateful for Professor Flitwick's gigantic puffy beard. It was hard getting used to a professor who was not only shorter than him, but spoke in a higher-pitched voice.
"Headmaster Dumbledore may seem a little odd, or a lot odd, or even extremely odd, but he has never hurt a student in the slightest, and I don't believe he ever will."
Professor Flitwick gave Harry an encouraging smile.
"Just keep that in mind at all times, and you'll be sure not to panic."
This was not helping.
"Good luck,"
squeaked Professor Flitwick, and leaned over to the gargoyle and said something that Harry somehow failed to hear at all. Of course, the password wouldn't be much good if you could hear someone saying it. And the stone gargoyle walked aside with a very natural and ordinary movement that Harry found rather shocking, since the gargoyle still looked like solid, immovable stone the whole time. Behind the gargoyle was a set of slowly revolving spiral stairs. There was something disturbingly hypnotic about it, and even more disturbing was that revolving the spiral ought not to take you anywhere.
"Up you go,"
squeaked Flitwick. Harry rather nervously stepped onto the spiral and found himself, for some reason that his brain couldn't seem to visualize at all, moving upwards. The gargoyle thudded back into place behind him, and the spiral stairs kept turning, and Harry kept being higher up, and after a rather dizzying time, Harry found himself in front of an oak door with a brass griffin knocker. Harry reached out and turned the doorknob. The door swung open, and Harry saw the most interesting room he had ever seen in his life. There were tiny metal mechanisms that whirred or ticked or slowly changed shape or emitted little puffs of smoke. There were dozens of mysterious fluids in dozens of oddly shaped containers, all bubbling, boiling, oozing, changing colour or forming into interesting shapes that vanished half a second after you saw them. There were things that looked like clocks with many hands, inscribed with numbers or in unrecognisable languages. There was a bracelet bearing a lenticular crystal that sparkled with a thousand colours, and a bird perched atop a golden platform, and a wooden cup filled with what looked like blood, and a statue of a falcon encrusted in black enamel. The wall was hung with pictures of people sleeping, and the sorting hat was casually poised on a hat rack that was also holding two umbrellas and three red slippers for left feet. In the midst of all the chaos was a clean, black oaken desk. Before the desk was an oaken stool, and behind the desk was a well-cushioned throne containing Albus, Percival, Wulfric, Brian, Dumbledore, who was adorned with a long silver beard, a hat like a squashed giant mushroom, and what looked to muggle eyes like three layers of bright pink pyjamas. Dumbledore was smiling, and his bright eyes twinkled with a mad intensity. With some trepidation, Harry seated himself in front of the desk. The door swung shut behind him with a loud thunk.
"Hello, Harry," said Dumbledore.
"Hello, Headmaster," Harry replied. So, they were on a first-name basis? Would Dumbledore now say to call him?
"Please, Harry," said Dumbledore. "Headmaster sounds so formal. Just call me Heh for short."
"I'll be sure to, Heh," said Harry.
There was a slight pause.
"Do you know," said Dumbledore, "you're the first person who's ever taken me up on that?"
"Ah,"
Harry said. He tried to control his voice despite the sudden sinking feeling in his stomach.
"I'm sorry, Headmaster, you told me to do it, so I did."
"Heh, please," said Dumbledore cheerfully. "And there's no call to be so worried. I won't launch you out a window just because you made one mistake. I'll give you plenty of warnings first if you're doing something wrong. Besides, what matters isn't how people talk to you. It's what they think of you."
"He's never hurt a student. Just keep remembering that, and you'll be sure not to panic."
Dumbledore drew forth a small metal case and flipped it open, showing some small yellow lumps.
"Sherbet lemon?" said the headmaster.
No, thank you, Heh,"
said Harry.
"Does slipping a student LSD count as hurting them, or does that fall into the category of harmless fun? You, said something about my being too young to invoke the words of power and madness."
"That you most certainly are," Dumbledore said. "Thankfully, the words of power and madness were lost 7 centuries ago, and no one has the slightest idea what they are anymore. It was just a little remark."
"Ah,"
Harry said. He was aware that his mouth was hanging open.
"Why did you call me here, then?"
"Why?" Dumbledore repeated. "Ah, Harry, if I went around all day asking
why I do things. I'd never have time to get a single thing done. I'm quite a busy person, you know.
Harry nodded, smiling.
Yes, it was a very impressive list. Headmaster of Hogwarts, Chief Warlock of the Wizengamot, and Supreme Mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards. Sorry to ask, but I was wondering, is it possible to get more than 6 hours if you use more than one time-turner? Because it's pretty impressive if you're doing all that on just 30 hours a day.
There was another slight pause, during which Harry went on smiling. He was a little apprehensive, a lot apprehensive, but once it had become clear that Dumbledore was deliberately messing with him, something within him absolutely refused to sit and take it like a defenseless lump.
I'm afraid time doesn't like being stretched out too much, said Dumbledore after the slight pause. And yet we ourselves seem to be a little too large for it. And so it's a constant struggle to fit our lives into time. Indeed,
Harry said with grave solemnity.
That's why it's best to come to our points quickly.
For a moment, Harry wondered if he'd gone too far. Then Dumbledore chuckled.
Straight to the point it shall be.
The headmaster leaned forwards, tilting his squashed mushroom hat and brushing his beard against his desk.
Harry, this Monday you did something that should have been impossible, even with a time-turner. Or, rather, impossible with only a time-turner. Where did those 2 pies come from, I wonder?
A jolt of adrenaline shot through Harry. He had done that using the Cloak of Invisibility, the one that had been given him in a Christmas box, along with a note, and that note had said, if Dumbledore saw a chance to possess one of the Deathly Hallows, he would never let it escape his grasp.
A natural thought,
Dumbledore went on,
is that since none of the first years present were able to cast such a spell, someone else was present, and yet unseen. And if no one could see them, why, it would be easy enough for them to throw the pies. One might further suspect that since you had a time-turner, you were the invisible one. And that, since the spell of disillusionment is far beyond your current abilities, you had an invisibility cloak.
Dumbledore smiled conspiratorially.
Am I on the right track so far, Harry?
Harry was frozen. He had the feeling that an outright lie would not at all be wise, and possibly not the least bit helpful, and he couldn't think of anything else to say. Dumbledore waved a friendly hand.
Oh, don't worry, Harry. You haven't done anything wrong. Invisibility cloaks aren't against the rules. I suppose they're rare enough that no one ever got around to putting them on the list. But really, I was wondering something else entirely.
Oh?
Harry said in the most normal voice he could manage. Dumbledore's eyes shone with enthusiasm.
You see, Harry, after you've been through a few adventures, you tend to catch the hang of these things. You start to see the pattern, hear the rhythm of the world. You begin to harbor suspicions before the moment of revelation. You are the boy who lived, And somehow, an invisibility cloak made its way into your hands only 4 days after you discovered our magical Britain. Such cloaks are not for sale in Diagon Alley, but there is one which might find its own way to a destined wearer. And so, I cannot help but wonder if by some strange chance you have found not just an invisibility cloak, but the cloak of invisibility, one of the 3 deathly hallows, and reputed to hide the wearer from the gaze of death himself.
Dumbledore's gaze was bright and eager.
May I see it, Harry?
Harry swallowed. There was a full flood of adrenaline in his system now, and it was entirely useless. This was the most powerful wizard in the world, and there was no way he could make it out the door, and there was nowhere in Hogwarts for him to hide if he did. He was about to lose the cloak that had been passed down through the Potters for who knew how long. Slowly, Dumbledore leaned back into his high chair. The bright light had gone out of his eyes, and he looked puzzled and a little sorrowful.
"Harry," said Dumbledore, "if you don't want to, you can just say no."
"I can?"
Harry croaked.
"Yes, Harry," said Dumbledore.
His voice sounded sad now and worried.
"It seems that you're afraid of me, Harry. May I ask what I've done to earn your distrust?"
Harry swallowed.
"Is there some way you can swear a binding magical oath that you won't take my cloak?"
Dumbledore shook his head slowly.
"Unbreakable vows are not to be used so lightly. And besides, Harry, if you did not already know the spell, you would have only my word that the spell was binding. Yet, surely, you realize that I do not need your permission to see the cloak. I am powerful enough to draw it forth myself, moleskin pouch or no."
Dumbledore's face was very grave.
"But this I will not do. The cloak is yours, Harry. I will not seize it from you, not even to look at it for just a moment, unless you decide to show it to me. That is a promise and an oath. Should I need to prohibit you from using it on the school grounds, I will require you to go to your vault at Gringotts and store it there."
"Ah,"
Harry said. He swallowed hard, trying to calm the flood of adrenaline and think reasonably. He took the moleskin pouch off his belt.
"If you really don't need my permission, then you have it."
Harry held out the pouch to Dumbledore and bit down hard on his lip, sending that signal to himself in case he was obliviated afterwards. The old wizard reached into the pouch and, without saying any word of retrieval, drew forth the cloak of invisibility.
"Ah,"
breathed Dumbledore.
"I was right."
He poured the shimmering black velvet mesh through his hand.
"Centuries old, and still as perfect as the day it was made. We have lost much of our art over the years, and now I cannot make such a thing myself. No one can. I can feel the power of it like an echo in my mind, like a song forever being sung, without anyone to hear it.
The wizard looked up from the cloak.
"Do not sell it," he said. "Do not give it to anyone as a possession. Think twice before you show it to anyone, and ponder three times again before you reveal it as a deathly hallow. Treat it with respect, for this is indeed a thing of power."
For a moment, Dumbledore's face grew wistful. And then he handed the cloak back to Harry. Harry put it back in his pouch. Dumbledore's face was grave once more.
"May I ask again, Harry, how you came to distrust me so?"
Suddenly Harry felt rather ashamed.
"There was a note with the cloak,"
Harry said in a small voice.
"It said that you would try to take the cloak from me if you knew. I don't know who left the note, though. I really don't."
"I see,"
Dumbledore said slowly.
"Well, Harry, I won't impugn the motives of whoever left you that note. Who knows but that they themselves may have had the best of good intentions? They did give you the cloak, after all."
Harry nodded, impressed by Dumbledore's charity, and abashed at the sharp contrast with his own attitude. The old wizard went on.
"But you and I are both game pieces of the same colour, I think. The boy who finally defeated Voldemort, and the old man who held him off long enough for you to save the day. I will not hold your caution against you, Harry. We must all do our best to be wise. I will only ask that you think twice, and ponder three times again the next time someone tells you to distrust me."
"I'm sorry,"
Harry said. He felt wretched at this point. He'd just told off Gandalf, essentially, and Dumbledore's kindness was only making him feel worse.
"I shouldn't have distrusted you."
"Alas, Harry, in this world,"
the old wizard shook his head,
"I cannot even say you were unwise. You did not know me, and, in truth, there are some at Hogwarts who you would do well not to trust. Perhaps even some you call friends."
Harry swallowed. That sounded rather ominous.
"Like who?"
Dumbledore stood up from his chair and began examining one of his instruments, a dial with eight hands of varying length. After a few moments, the old wizard spoke again.
"He probably seems to you quite charming," said Dumbledore. "Polite, to you at least. Well-spoken, maybe even admiring. Always ready with a helping hand, a favour, a word of advice."
"Oh, Draco Malfoy!"
Harry said, feeling rather relieved that it wasn't Hermione or something.
"Oh, no, 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 no. You've got it all wrong. He's not turning me. I'm turning him."
Dumbledore froze where he was, peering at the dial.
"You're what?"
"I'm going to turn Draco Malfoy from the dark side,"
Harry said.
"You know, make him a good guy."
Dumbledore straightened and turned to Harry. He was wearing one of the most astonished expressions Harry had ever seen on anyone, let alone someone with a long silver beard.
are you certain, said the old wizard after a moment, that he is ready to be redeemed? I fear that whatever goodness you think you see within him is only wishful thinking, or worse, a lure, a bait.
Not likely, Harry said. I mean, if he's trying to disguise himself as a good guy, he's incredibly bad at it. This isn't a question of Draco coming up to me and being all charming and me deciding that he must have a hidden core of goodness deep down. I selected him for redemption specifically because he's the heir to House Malfoy, and if you had to pick one person to redeem, it would obviously be him.
Dumbledore's left eye twitched.
You intend to sow seeds of love and kindness in Draco Malfoy's heart because you expect Malfoy's heir to prove valuable to you?
Not just me, Harry said indignantly. To all of magical Britain, if this works out. And he'll have a happier and mentally healthier life himself. Look, I don't have enough time to turn everyone away from the dark side, and I've got to ask where the light can gain the most advantage the fastest.
Dumbledore started laughing. Laughing a lot harder than Harry would expect, almost howling. It seemed positively undignified. An ancient and powerful wizard ought to chuckle in deep, booming tones, not laugh so hard he was gasping for breath. Harry had once literally fallen out of his chair while watching the Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup, and that was how hard Dumbledore was laughing now.
"It's not that funny,"
Harry said after a while. He was starting to worry about Dumbledore's sanity again. Dumbledore got himself under control again with a visible effort.
Harry, one symptom of the disease called wisdom is that you begin laughing at things that no one else thinks is funny. Because when you're wise, Harry, you start getting the jokes.
The old wizard wiped tears away from his eyes.
Ah me, oft evil will shall evil mar indeed, in very deed.
Harry's brain took a moment to place the familiar words.
Hey, that's a talking quote. Gandalf says that.
Theoden, actually, said Dumbledore.
You're Muggleborn?
Harry said in shock.
I'm afraid not,
said Dumbledore, smiling again.
I was born 70 years before that book was published, dear child. But it seems that my Muggleborn students tend to think alike in certain ways. I have accumulated no fewer than 20 copies of The Lord of the Rings, and 3 sets of Tolkien's entire collected works, and I treasure every one of them.
Dumbledore drew his wand and held it up and struck a pose.
You cannot pass! How does that look?
Harry said in something approaching complete brain shutdown.
I think you're missing a Balrog.
And the pink pyjamas and squashed mushroom hat were not helping in the slightest.
Ah, I see.
Dumbledore sighed and glumly sheathed the wand in his belt.
I fear there have been precious few Balrogs in my life of late. Nowadays, it's all meetings of the Wizengamots where I must try desperately to prevent any work from getting done, and formal dinners where foreign politicians compete to see who can be the most obstinate fool. And being mysterious at people, knowing things I have no way of knowing, making cryptic statements which can only be understood in hindsight, and all the other small ways in which powerful wizards amuse themselves after they have left the part of the pattern that allows them to be heroes. Speaking of which, Harry, I have a certain something to give you. Something which belonged to your father.
You do? Said Harry. Gosh, who would have figured?
Yes, indeed, said Dumbledore. I suppose it is a little predictable, isn't it?
His face turned solemn.
Nonetheless.
Dumbledore went back to his desk and sat down, pulling out one of the drawers as he did so. He reached in, using both arms, and, straining slightly, pulled a rather large and heavy-looking object out of the drawer, which he then deposited on his oaken desk with a huge thunk.
"This," Dumbledore said, "was your father's rock."
Harry stared at it. It was light grey, discoloured, irregularly shaped, sharp edge, and very much a plain old ordinary large rock. Dumbledore had deposited it so that it rested on the widest available cross-section, but it still wobbled unstably on his desk. Harry looked up.
"This is a joke, right?"
"It is not," said Dumbledore, shaking his head and looking very serious. "I took this from the ruins of James and Lily's home in Godric's Hollow, where I also found you, and I have kept it from then until now, against the day when I could give it to you."
In the mixture of hypotheses that served as Harry's model of the world, Dumbledore's insanity was rapidly rising in probability. But there was still a substantial amount of probability allocated to other alternatives.
Is it a magical rock?
Not so far as I know, said Dumbledore. But I advise you, with the greatest possible stringency, to keep it close about your person at all times.
All right. Dumbledore was probably insane. But if he wasn't,
well, it would be just too embarrassing to get in trouble from ignoring the advice of the inscrutable old wizard. That had to be, like, number 4 on the list of the top 100 obvious failure modes.
Harry stepped forward and put his hands on the rock, trying to find some angle from which to lift it without cutting himself.
"I'll put it in my pouch, then."
Dumbledore frowned.
"That may not be close enough to your person. And what if your moleskin pouch is lost or stolen?"
"You think I should just carry a big rock everywhere I go?"
Dumbledore gave Harry a serious look.
"That might prove wise."
"Ah,"
Harry said. It looked rather heavy.
"I'd think the other students would tend to ask me questions about that."
"Tell them I ordered you to do it," said Dumbledore. "No one will question that, since they all think I'm insane."
His face was still perfectly serious.
To be honest, if you go around ordering your students to carry large rocks, I can kind of see why people would think that.
Ah, Harry, said Dumbledore.
The old wizard gestured, a sweep of one hand that seemed to take in all the mysterious instruments around the room.
When we are young, we believe that we know everything, and so we believe that if we see no explanation for something, then no explanation exists. When we are older, we realize that the whole universe works by a rhythm and a reason, even if we ourselves do not know it. It is only our own ignorance which appears to us as insanity.
Reality is always lawful, said Harry, even if we don't know the law.
Precisely, Harry, said Dumbledore. To understand this, and I see that you do understand it, is the essence of wisdom.
So, why do I have to carry this rock, exactly?
I can't think of a reason, actually, said Dumbledore.
You can't.
Dumbledore nodded.
But just because I can't think of a reason doesn't mean there is no reason.
The instruments ticked on.
Okay, said Harry. I'm not even sure if I should be saying this, but that is simply not the correct way to deal with our admitted ignorance of how the universe works.
It isn't,
said the old wizard, looking surprised and disappointed. Harry had the feeling this conversation was not going to work out in his favour, but he carried on regardless.
No, I don't even know if that fallacy has an official name. But if I had to make one up myself, it would be privileging the hypothesis, or something like that. How can I put this formally? Suppose you had 1,000,000 boxes, and only one of the boxes contained a diamond, and you had a box full of diamond detectors. Each diamond detector always went off in the presence of a diamond, and went off half the time on boxes that didn't have a diamond. If you ran 20 detectors over all the boxes, you'd have, on average, one false candidate and one true candidate left, and then it would just take one or two more detectors before you were left with the one true candidate. The point being that when there are lots of possible answers, most of the evidence you need goes into just locating the true hypothesis out of the millions of possibilities, bringing it to your attention in the first place. The amount of evidence you need to judge between two or three plausible candidates is much smaller by comparison. So, if you just jump ahead without evidence and promote one particular possibility to the focus of your attention, you're skipping over most of the work. Like, you live in a city where there are 1,000,000 people, and there's a murder, and a detective says, "Well, we've got no evidence at all, so have we considered the possibility that Mortimer Snodgrass did it?"
Did he? Said Dumbledore.
No, said Harry. But later it turns out that the murderer had black hair and Mortimer has black hair. So everyone's like, "Ah, looks like Mortimer did it after all." So it's unfair to Mortimer for the police to promote him to their attention without having good reasons already in hand to suspect him. When there are lots of possibilities, most of the work goes into just locating the true answer, starting to pay attention to it. You don't need proof, or the sort of official evidence that scientists or courts demand, but you need some sort of hint. And that hint has to discriminate that particular possibility from the millions of others. Otherwise, you can't just pluck the right answer out of thin air. You can't even pluck a possibility worth thinking about out of thin air. And there's got to be a million other things I could do besides carrying around my father's rock. Just because I'm ignorant about the universe doesn't mean that I'm unsure about how I should reason in the presence of my uncertainty. The laws for thinking with probabilities are no less iron than the laws that govern old-fashioned logic. And what you just did is not allowed.
Harry paused.
Unless, of course, you have some hint you're not mentioning.
Ah, said Dumbledore. He tapped his cheek, looking thoughtful.
An interesting argument, certainly, but doesn't it break down at the point where you make an analogy between a million potential murderers, only one of whom committed the murder, and taking one out of many possible courses of action, when many possible courses of action may all be wise? I do not say that carrying your father's rock is the one best possible course of action, only that it is wiser to do than not.
Dumbledore once again reached into the same desk drawer he had accessed earlier, this time seeming to root around inside. At least his arm seemed to be moving.
I will remark, Dumbledore said while Harry was still trying to sort out how to reply to this completely unexpected rejoinder, that it is a common misconception of Ravenclaw's that all the smart children are sorted there, leaving none for other houses. This is not so. Being sorted into Ravenclaw indicates that you are driven by your desire to know things, which is not at all the same quality as being intelligent.
The wizard was smiling as he bent over the drawer.
Nonetheless, you do seem rather intelligent, less like an ordinary young hero and more like a young, mysterious, ancient wizard. I think I may have been taking the wrong approach with you, Harry, and that you may be able to understand things that few others could grasp. So, I shall be daring and offer you a certain other heirloom.
You don't mean, gasped Harry. My father owned another rock?
Excuse me, said Dumbledore. I am still older and more mysterious than you, and if there are any revelations to be made, then I will do the revealing. Thank you. Oh, where is that thing?
Dumbledore reached down further into the desk drawer, and still further. His head and shoulders and whole torso disappeared inside until only his hips and legs were sticking out, as though the desk drawer was eating him. Harry couldn't help but wonder just how much stuff was in there and what the complete inventory would look like. Finally, Dumbledore rose back up out of the drawer, holding the object of his search, which he set down on the desk alongside the rock. It was a used, ragged-edged, worn-spined textbook.
Intermediate Potion Making by Libatius Borage.
There was a picture of a smoking vial on the cover.
This, Dumbledore intoned, was your mother's fifth-year potions textbook.
Which I am to carry with me at all times, said Harry.
Which holds a terrible secret. A secret whose revelation could prove so disastrous that I must ask you to swear. And I do require you to swear it seriously, Harry. Whatever you may think of all this, never to tell anyone or anything else.
Harry considered his mother's fifth-year potions textbook, which, apparently, held a terrible secret. The problem was that Harry did take oaths like that very seriously. Any vow was an unbreakable vow if made by the right sort of person. And
I'm feeling thirsty, Harry said. And that's not at all a good sign.
Dumbledore entirely failed to ask any questions about this cryptic statement.
Do you swear, Harry?
Said Dumbledore. His eyes gazed intently into Harry's.
Otherwise I cannot tell you.
Yes, said Harry. I swear.
That was the trouble with being a Ravenclaw. You couldn't refuse an offer like that, or your curiosity would eat you alive. And everyone else knew it.
And I swear in turn, said Dumbledore, that what I am about to tell you is the truth.
Dumbledore opened the book, seemingly at random, and Harry leaned in to see.
Do you see these notes?
Dumbledore said in a voice so low it was almost a whisper.
Written in the margins of the book.
Harry squinted slightly. The yellowing pages seemed to be describing something called a potion of eagle's splendour, many of the ingredients being items that Harry didn't recognise at all and whose names didn't appear to derive from English. Scrawled in the margin was a handwritten annotation saying, I wonder what would happen if you used Thestral blood here instead of blueberries. And immediately beneath was a reply in different handwriting. You'd get sick for weeks and maybe die.
I see them, said Harry. What about them?
Dumbledore pointed to the second scrawl.
The ones in this handwriting,
he said, still in that low voice,
were written by your mother. And the ones in this handwriting,
moving his finger to indicate the first scrawl,
were written by me. I would turn myself invisible and sneak into her dorm room while she was sleeping. Lily thought one of her friends was writing them, and they had the most amazing fights.
That was the exact point at which Harry realized that the headmaster of Hogwarts was, in fact, crazy. Dumbledore was looking at him with a serious expression.
Do you understand the implications of what I have just told you, Harry?
Harry said. His voice seemed to be stuck.
Sorry, not really.
Ah, well,
said Dumbledore and sighed.
I suppose your cleverness has limits, after all, then. Shall we all just pretend I didn't say anything?
Harry rose from his chair, wearing a fixed smile.
Of course, Harry said. You know, it's actually getting rather late in the day, and I'm a bit hungry. So I should be going down to dinner, really.
And Harry made a beeline for the door. The doorknob entirely failed to turn.
You wound me, Harry, said Dumbledore's voice in quiet tones that were coming from right behind him. Do you not at least realize that what I have told you is a sign of trust?
Harry slowly turned around. In front of him was a very powerful and very insane wizard, with a long silver beard, a hat like a squashed giant mushroom, and wearing what looked to muggle eyes like three layers of bright pink pyjamas. Behind him was a door that didn't seem to be working at the moment. Dumbledore was looking rather saddened and weary, like he wanted to lean on a wizard's staff he didn't have.
Really, said Dumbledore, you try anything new instead of following the same pattern every time for 110 years, and people all start running away.
The old wizard shook his head in sorrow.
I'd hoped for better from you, Harry Potter. I'd heard that your own friends also think you mad. I know they are mistaken. Will you not believe the same of me?
Please open the door, Harry said, his voice trembling. If you ever want me to trust you again, open the door. There was a sound behind him of a door opening.
There were more things I planned to say to you, Dumbledore said. And if you leave now, you will not know what they were.
Sometimes Harry absolutely hated being a Ravenclaw.
He's never hurt a student, said Harry's Gryffindor side. Just keep remembering that, and you'll be sure not to panic. You're not going to run away just because things are getting interesting, are you? You can't just walk out on the headmaster,
said the Hufflepuff part.
What if he starts deducting house points? He could make your school life very difficult if he decides he doesn't like you.
And a piece of himself which Harry didn't much like but couldn't quite manage to silence was pondering the potential advantages of being one of the few friends of this mad old wizard who also happened to be headmaster, chief warlock, and supreme mugwump. And, unfortunately, his inner Slytherin seemed to be much better than Draco at turning people to the dark side, because it was saying things like,
"Poor fellow! He looks like he needs someone to talk to, doesn't he?"
And,
"You wouldn't want such a powerful man to end up trusting someone less virtuous, would you?"
And,
"I wonder what sort of incredible secrets Dumbledore could tell you if, you know, you became friends with him."
And even,
"I bet he's got a really interesting book collection." "Bah! You're all a bunch of lunatics,"
Harry thought at the entire assemblage. But he'd been unanimously outvoted by every component part of himself. Harry turned, took a step towards the open door, reached out, and deliberately closed it again. It was a costless sacrifice, given that he was staying anyway. Dumbledore could control his movements regardless, but maybe it would impress Dumbledore. When Harry turned back around, he saw that the powerful, insane wizard was once more smiling and looking friendly. "That was good. Maybe,"
"Please don't do that again," Harry said. "I don't like being trapped."
"I am sorry about that, Harry,"
said Dumbledore in what sounded like tones of sincere apology.
"But it would have been terribly unwise to let you leave without your father's rock."
"Of course," Harry said. "It wasn't reasonable of me to expect the door to open before I put the quest items in my inventory."
Dumbledore smiled and nodded. Harry went over to the desk, twisted his moleskin pouch around to the front of his belt, and, with some effort, managed to heave up the rock in his 11-year-old arms and feed it in. He could actually feel the weight slowly diminishing as the widening lip charm ate the rock, and the burp which followed was rather noisy and had a distinctly complaining sound to it. His mother's fifth-year potions textbook, which held a secret that was in fact pretty terrible, followed shortly after. And then Harry's inner Slytherin made a sly suggestion for ingratiating himself with the headmaster, which unfortunately had been perfectly pitched in such a way as to gain the support of the majority Ravenclaw faction.
"So," Harry said, "as long as I'm hanging around, I don't suppose you'd like to give me a bit of a tour of your office? I'm a bit curious as to what some of these things are." And that was his understatement for the month of September. Dumbledore gazed at him, and then nodded with a slight grin.
"I'm flattered by your interest," said Dumbledore, "but I'm afraid there isn't much to say."
Dumbledore took a step closer to the wall and pointed to a painting of a sleeping man.
"These are the portraits of past headmasters of Hogwarts."
He turned and pointed to his desk.
"This is my desk."
He pointed to his chair.
"This is my chair."
"Excuse me," Harry said. "Actually, I was wondering about those."
He pointed to a small cube that was softly whispering. "Blubber, blubber, blubber."
"Oh, the little fiddly things," said Dumbledore. "They came with the headmaster's office, and I have absolutely no idea what most of them do. Although this dial with the eight hands counts the number of, let's call them sneezes, by the left-handed witches within the borders of France. You would not believe how much work it took to nail that down. And this one with the golden wibblers is my own invention, and Minerva is never, ever going to figure out what it's doing."
Dumbledore took a step over to the hat rack while Harry was still processing this.
"Here, of course, we have the sorting hats. I believe the two of you have met. It told me that it was never again to be placed on your head under any circumstances. You're only the 14th student in history it said that about. Baba Yaga was another one, and I'll tell you about the other 12 when you're older. This is an umbrella. This is another umbrella."
Dumbledore took another few steps and turned around, now smiling quite broadly.
"And, of course, most people who come to my office want to see forks."
Dumbledore was standing next to the bird on the golden platform. Harry came over, rather puzzled.
"This is forks?"
"Forks is a phoenix," said Dumbledore. "Very rare, very powerful magical creatures.
Ah,
Harry said. He lowered his head and stared into the tiny, beady black eyes, which showed not the slightest sign of power or intelligence.
Ah,
Harry said again. He was pretty sure he recognized the shape of the bird. It was pretty hard to miss.
Say something intelligent.
Harry's mind roared at itself.
Don't just stand there sounding like a gibbering moron. Well, what the heck am I supposed to say?
Harry's mind fired back.
Anything. You mean anything besides Fawkes is a chicken? Yes, anything but that. So, what sort of magic do phoenixes do, then?
Their tears have the power to heal,
Dumbledore said.
They are creatures of fire, and move between all places as easily as fire may extinguish itself in one place and be kindled in another. The tremendous strain of their innate magic ages their bodies quickly, and yet they are as close to undying as any creature that exists in this world, for whenever their bodies fail them, they immolate themselves in a burst of fire, and leave behind a hatchling, or sometimes an egg.
Dumbledore came closer and inspected the chicken, frowning.
Looking a little peaky there, I'd say.
By the time this statement registered fully in Harry's mind, the chicken was already on fire. The chicken's beak opened, but it didn't have time for so much as a single core before it began to wither and char. The blaze was brief, intense, and entirely self-contained. There was no smell of burning. And then the fire died down only seconds after it had begun, leaving behind a tiny, pathetic heap of ashes on the golden platform.
Don't look so horrified, Harry, said Dumbledore. Fawkes hasn't been hurt.
Dumbledore's hand dipped into a pocket, and then the same hand sifted through the ashes and turned up a small, yellowish egg.
Look, here's an egg.
Oh, wow, amazing.
But now we really should get on with things,
Dumbledore said. Leaving the egg behind in the ashes of the chicken, he returned to his throne and seated himself.
It's almost time for dinner, after all, and we wouldn't want to have to use our time-turners.
There was a violent power struggle going on in the government of Harry. Slytherin and Hufflepuff had switched sides after seeing the headmaster of Hogwarts set fire to a chicken.
Yes, things, said Harry's lips. And then dinner. You're sounding like a gibbering moron again,
observed Harry's inner critic.
Well,
Dumbledore said,
I fear I have a confession to make, Harry. A confession and an apology.
Apologies are good. That doesn't even make sense. What am I talking about?
The old wizard sighed deeply.
You may not still think so after understanding what I have to say. I'm afraid, Harry, that I've been manipulating you your entire life. It was I who consigned you to the care of your wicked step-parents.
My step-parents aren't wicked,
blurted Harry.
My parents, I mean.
They aren't,
Dumbledore said, looking surprised and disappointed.
Not even a little wicked? That doesn't fit the pattern.
Harry's inner Slytherin screamed at the top of its mental lungs.
Shut up, you idiot! He'll take you away from them! No, no,
said Harry, lips frozen in a ghastly grimace.
I was just trying to spare your feelings. They're actually very wicked.
They are?
Dumbledore leaned forward, gazing at him intently.
What do they do?
Talk fast. I have to do dishes and watch problems, and they don't let me read a lot of books and...
Ah, good. That's good to hear,
said Dumbledore, leaning back again. He smiled in a sad sort of way.
I apologize for that, then. Now, where was I? Yes. I'm sorry to say, Harry, that I am responsible for virtually everything bad that has ever happened to you. I know that this will probably make you very angry.
Yes, I'm very angry, said Harry.
Harry's internal critic promptly awarded him the all-time award for the worst acting in the history of ever.
And I just wanted you to know,
Dumbledore said,
I wanted to tell you as early as possible, in case something happens to one of us later, that I am truly, truly sorry for everything that has already happened and everything that will.
Moisture glistened in the old wizard's eyes.
And I am very angry, said Harry. So angry that I want to leave right now, unless you've got anything else to say. Just go before he sets you on fire,
shrieked Slytherin, Hufflepuff, and Gryffindor.
I understand, said Dumbledore. One last thing, then, Harry. You are not to attempt the forbidden door on the third floor corridor. There's no possible way you could get through all the traps, and I wouldn't want to hear that you'd been hurt trying. Why, I doubt that you could so much as open the first door, since it's locked and you don't know the spell Alohomora.
Harry spun around and bolted for the exit at top speed. The doorknob turned agreeably in his hand, and then he was racing down the spiral stairs, even as they turned, his feet almost stumbling over themselves. In just a moment he was at the bottom, and the gargoyle was walking aside, and Harry fired out of the stairwell like a cannon. Harry Potter. There must have been something about Harry Potter. It was Thursday for everyone, after all. And yet, this sort of thing didn't seem to happen to anyone else. It was 6:21 p.m. on Thursday afternoon when Harry Potter, firing out of the stairwell like a cannonball and accelerating at top speed, ran directly into Minerva McGonagall as she was turning a corner on her way to the headmaster's office. Thankfully, neither of them were much hurt, as had been explained to Harry a little earlier in the day, back when he was refusing to go anywhere near a broomstick again. Quidditch needed solid iron bludgers just to stand a chance of injuring the players, since wizards tended to be a lot more resistant than muggles to impacts. Harry and Professor McGonagall did both end up on the floor, and the parchment she had been carrying went all over the corridor. There was a terrible, terrible pause.
Harry Potter,
breathed Professor McGonagall from where she was lying on the floor right next to Harry. Her voice rose to nearly a shriek.
"What were you doing in the headmaster's office?"
"Nothing,"
squeaked Harry.
"Were you talking about the defence professor?"
"No. Dumbledore called me up there and gave me this big rock and said it was my father's and I should carry it everywhere."
There was another terrible pause.
"I see,"
said Professor McGonagall, her voice a little calmer. She stood up, brushed herself off, and glared at the scattered parchments, which jumped into a neat stack and scurried back against the corridor wall as though to hide from her gaze.
"My sympathies, Mr. Potter, and I apologize for doubting you."
"Professor McGonagall," Harry said, his voice wavering.
He pushed himself off the floor, stood and looked up at her trustworthy, sane face.
"Professor McGonagall."
"Yes, Mr. Potter."
"Do you think I should,"
Harry said in a small voice,
"carry my father's rock everywhere?"
Professor McGonagall sighed.
"That is between you and the headmaster, I'm afraid."
She hesitated.
"I will say that ignoring the headmaster completely is almost never wise. I am sorry to hear of your dilemma, Mr. Potter, and if there's any way I can help you with whatever you decide to do..."
Harry said, "actually, I was thinking that once I know how, I could transfigure the rock into a ring and wear it on my finger. If you could teach me how to sustain a transfiguration..."
"It is good that you asked me first,"
Professor McGonagall said, her face growing a bit stern.
"If you lost control of the transfiguration, the reversal would cut off your finger and probably rip your hand in half. At your age, even a ring is too large of a target for you to sustain indefinitely without it being a serious drain on your magic. But I can have a ring forged for you with a setting for a jewel. A small jewel in contact with your skin, and you can practice sustaining a safe subject, like a marshmallow. When you have kept it up successfully, even in your sleep, for a full month, I will allow you to transfigure your father's rock."
Professor McGonagall's voice trailed off.
"Did the headmaster really..."
"Yes.
Professor McGonagall sighed.
"That's a bit strange, even for him."
She stooped and picked up the stack of parchments.
"I'm sorry about this, Mr. Potter. I apologize again for mistrusting you. But now it's my own turn to see the headmaster."
Good luck, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Potter."
Professor McGonagall walked over to the gargoyle, inaudibly spoke the password, and stepped through into the revolving spiral stairs. She began to rise out of sight, and the gargoyle started back.
"Professor McGonagall, the headmaster set fire to a chicken!"
"He what?"
Chapter 18. Dominance Hierarchies.
"That does sound like the sort of thing I would do, doesn't it?"
It was breakfast time on Friday morning. Harry took another huge bite out of his toast and then tried to remind his brain that scarfing his breakfast wouldn't actually get him into the dungeons any faster. Anyway, they had a full hour of study time between breakfast and the start of potions. But dungeons in Hogwarts! Harry's imagination was already sketching the chasms, narrow bridges, torch-lit sconces and patches of glowing moss. Would there be rats? Would there be dragons?
Harry Potter,
said a quiet voice from behind him. Harry looked over his shoulder and found himself beholding Ernie Macmillan, smartly dressed in yellow-trimmed robes and looking a little worried.
Never thought I should warn you,
Ernie said in a low voice.
I think he's right. Be careful of the potions master in our session today. The older Hufflepuffs told us that Professor Snape can be really nasty at people he doesn't like, and he doesn't like most people who aren't Slytherins. If you say anything smart to him, it could be really bad for you, from what I've heard. Just keep your head down and don't give him any reason to notice you.
There was a pause as Harry processed this, and then he lifted his eyebrows. Harry wished he could raise just one eyebrow, like Spock, but he'd never been able to manage.
"Thanks," Harry said. "You might have just saved me a lot of trouble."
Ernie nodded and turned to go back to the Hufflepuff table. Harry resumed eating his toast. It was around 4 bites afterward that someone said,
"Pardon me?"
And Harry turned around to see an older Ravenclaw looking a little worried. Some time later, Harry was finishing up his 3rd plate of rushes. He'd learned to eat heavily at breakfast. He could always eat lightly at lunch if he didn't end up using the time-turner. And there was yet another voice from behind him saying,
"Harry?" "Yes,"
Harry said wearily.
"I'll try not to draw Professor Snape's attention."
"Oh, that's hopeless," said Fred.
"Completely hopeless," said George.
"So we had the house elves bake you a cake," said Fred.
"We're going to put one candle on it for every point you lose for Ravenclaw," said George.
"And have a party for you at the Gryffindor table during lunch," said Fred.
"We hope that'll cheer you up afterward," finished George.
Harry swallowed his last bit of rasher and turned around.
"All right," said Harry. "I wasn't going to ask this after Professor Binns. I really wasn't. But if Professor Snape is that awful, why hasn't he been fired?"
"Fired?" said Fred.
"You mean let go?" said George.
"Yes,"
Harry said.
"It's what you do to bad teachers. You fire them, then you hire a better teacher instead. You don't have unions or tenure here, right?"
Fred and George were frowning in much the same way that hunter-gatherer tribal elders might frown if you tried to tell them about calculus.
"I don't know," said Fred after a while. "I've never thought about that."
"Me neither," said George.
"Yeah," said Harry. "I get that a lot. See you at lunch, guys, and don't blame me if there aren't any candles on that cake."
Fred and George both laughed as if Harry had said something funny, and bowed to him and headed back toward Gryffindor. Harry turned back to the breakfast table and grabbed a cupcake. His stomach already felt full, but he had a feeling this morning might use a lot of calories. As he ate his cupcake, Harry thought of the worst teacher he'd met so far, Professor Binns of History. Professor Binns was a ghost. From what Hermione had said about ghosts, it didn't seem likely that they were fully self-aware. There were no famous discoveries made by ghosts,
or much of any original work, no matter who they'd been in life. Ghosts tended to have trouble remembering the current century. Hermione had said they were like accidental portraits, impressed into the surrounding matter by a burst of psychic energy accompanying a wizard's sudden death. Harry had run into some stupid teachers during his abortive forays into standard Muggle education. His father had been a lot pickier when it came to selecting grad students as tutors, of course, but history class was the first time he'd encountered a teacher who literally wasn't sentient. And it showed, too. Harry had given up after 5 minutes and started reading a textbook. When it became clear that Professor Binns wasn't going to object, Harry had also reached into his pouch and gotten earplugs. Did ghosts not require a salary? Was that it? Or was it literally impossible to fire anyone in Hogwarts, even if they died? Now, it seemed that Professor Snape was going about being absolutely awful to everyone who wasn't a Slytherin, and it hadn't even occurred to anyone to terminate his contract. And the headmaster had set fire to a chicken.
"Excuse me,"
came a worried voice from behind him.
"I swear," Harry said without turning around. "This place is almost 8.5% as bad as what Dad says about Oxford."
Harry stamped down the stone corridors, looking affronted, annoyed, and infuriated, all at once.
"Dungeons," Harry hissed. "Dungeons! These are not dungeons. This is a basement. A basement."
Some of the Ravenclaw girls gave him odd looks. The boys were all used to him by now. It seemed that the level in which the potions classroom was located was called the dungeons for no better reason than it was below ground and slightly colder than the main castle.
"In Hogwarts! In Hogwarts!"
Harry had been waiting his whole life, and now he was still waiting. And if there was anywhere on the face of the earth that had decent dungeons, it ought to be Hogwarts! Was Harry going to have to build his own castle if he wanted to see one little bottomless abyss? A short time later, they got to the actual potions classroom, and Harry cheered up considerably. The potions classroom had strange, preserved creatures floating in huge jars on shelves that covered every centimetre of wall space between the closets. Harry had gotten far enough along in his reading now that he could actually identify some of the creatures, like the Zabriskan Fontima. Albeit the 50-centimetre spider looked like an acromantula, but it was too small to be one. He'd tried asking Hermione, but she hadn't seemed very interested in looking anywhere near where he was pointing. Harry was looking at a large dust ball with eyes and feet when the assassin swept into the room. That was the first thought that crossed Harry's mind when he saw Professor Severus Snape. There was something quiet and deadly about the way the man stalked between the children's desks. His robes were unkempt, his hair spotted and greasy. There was something about him that seemed reminiscent of Lucius, although the two of them looked nothing remotely alike. And you got the impression that where Lucius would kill you with flawless elegance, this man would simply kill you.
"Sit down," said Professor Severus Snape. "Now."
Harry and a few other children who'd been standing around talking to each other scrambled for desks. Harry had planned on ending up next to Hermione, but somehow he found himself sitting down in the nearest empty desk next to Justin Finch-Fletchley,
It was a double session, Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff, which put him two desks to the left of Hermione. Severus seated himself behind the teacher's desk, and without the slightest transition or introduction, said,
"Hannah Abbott."
"Here?"
said Hannah in a somewhat trembling voice.
"Susan Bones."
"Present."
And so it went, no one daring to say a word in edgeways, until...
"Ah, yes, Harry Potter, our new celebrity."
"The celebrity is present, sir."
Half the class flinched, and some of the smarter ones suddenly looked that they wanted to run out the door while the classroom was still there. Severus smiled in an anticipatory sort of way and called the next name on his list. Harry gave a mental sigh. That had happened way too fast for him to do anything about it. Oh, well, clearly this man already didn't like him, for whatever reason. And when Harry thought about it, better by far that this potions professor should pick on him rather than, say, Neville or Hermione. Harry was a lot better able to defend himself. Yeah, probably all for the best. When full attendance had been taken, Severus swept his gaze over the full class. His eyes were as empty as a night sky without stars.
"You are here,"
Severus said in a quiet voice, which the students at the back strained to hear,
"to learn the subtle